This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Signature support comes from First Financial Tax and Accounting Services. And we're joined by Maya Cummings. She's the former chair of the Maryland Democratic Party and the widow of Elijah Cummings, the legendary congressman. His body lay in state last year. He died on the 17th of October of a year ago, and he's a legendary member of the U.S. House of Representatives. And, of course, he is a man who is missed immensely and one of the most prominent members of the Black Caucus for many years. And good morning to you, Maya Cummings.
Pleasure to be on with you this morning.
Well, it's nice to talk with you, and I know you, like your husband, have some concerns about where our country is going, and you have some ideas as a candidate for the seat that he vacated upon his death about how we can do better. What's the major problem, in your view, Maya, that we have in our country today?
Well, I think, first of all, let me just say this. Today, the Supreme Court will consider a case that my husband actually started as the chair of the Government Oversight Committee. Basically, he issued a subpoena for Donald J. Trump to turn over his records with regards to his taxes. And certainly that has now risen to the Supreme Court. And so if I was to say what the major problem is facing our country today, and I never thought I'd say this in a million years until Donald J. Trump got elected, and that is corruption. We have a major problem at the top of our country, and certainly I think that it's filtering down. And unfortunately, it's interfering with our ability to meet the needs of the country. So currently, we have an international pandemic that is affecting all communities across our country, but certainly around the world. And instead of unifying the nation and leading a coherent and consistent response, we have a president of the United States who wants to play the blame game, who wants to pit state against state, community against community, group against group, instead of being a leader. And I would say that that is our number one problem in the country today.
Maya Cummings is with us. She is a candidate for Maryland's 7th Congressional District. And she, of course, was married to Elijah Cummings. And he was a man that America came to know in the last few years. And, of course, some searing attacks came directed toward him, including questioning his obviously vast intelligence, by the President of the United States. Do you think Donald Trump went below the belt in his attacks on your husband and others, for that matter?
That is, the only tactic Donald Trump consistently shows himself capable of using effectively, and that is below the belt tactics. He has shown that he doesn't mind basically digging in the dirt. He doesn't mind rolling in the mud. He doesn't mind lobbing insults or, you know, racist diatribes or even unfounded conspiracy theories or even lies to try to undermine his opponent. He is a unique individual in, I think, the public life of America in terms of having a president who is so, I think, crass and certainly unfiltered when it comes to using brass ball tactics to go after opponents. And so he has, you know, created and brought in this atmosphere of fear and negativity, so much so that I think that it's pervaded the administration and inhibited its ability to actually function. Elijah was fighting till his last breath to make sure that we were able to preserve and protect our democracy. But it's going to take two strong parties to do that. And currently, we only have one party that's fully functioning, in my opinion, on behalf of the American people in a way that will get us to the kinds of solutions that we need to get through this crisis and beyond.
How did your husband respond to the attacks from the president?
So, what people need to understand, the context of it, is that he was fighting certainly a bigger demon, and that was, health challenges. My husband had a longstanding battle with cancer, and so he was trying to certainly fulfill his job duties while also making sure that he could stay healthy and in it for the fight. And so instead of going on some, big defense he basically, you know, refuted Donald Trump's comments, but he tried to take the conversation higher in terms of focusing on what we need to do to, of course, address challenges facing places like Baltimore City and other places like New Orleans and you know, places across the country, rural and urban, by the way. And so, it came and it went. Something that you all don't know is that, you know, literally hours before Donald Trump's diatribe is unleashing of his attack on my husband, we actually had a break-in in our house. Now, the break-in was foiled. And what was so fascinating about that break-in is that the gentleman who basically was able to penetrate two doors within our house before being before Elijah actually saw him on our video app for security, he didn't seem to have anything. He was riding a bike. It was just an interesting kind of break-in. And then several hours later, the president says what he says. And so we felt like we were under serious attack, that certainly the president's tactics are absolutely low. We know his verbal tactics are low. And while we do not know whether that break-in was at all related, we always felt that the fact that it was only hours apart was suspicious at best.
877-217-5757 for Maya Cummings. She is a person, of course, of significance in her own right. She was chair of the Maryland Democratic Party and is running for Congress against Kwesi Mfumi in the Democratic primary on June 2nd. And she is here and ready to take your inquiries if necessary, if you'd like to join us. Once again, 877-217-5757. And David in Atlanta. David, good morning. You're on the air with Maya Rockymore Cummings.
Good morning, Mrs. Cummings. It's an honor to have an audience with you. Elijah Cummings was a great, great statesman, something that's sadly lacking in the Congress of the United States. He reminds me of the great Sam Ervin, who distinguished himself during the Watergate crisis, the senator from North Carolina. And as far as I know, and I go through several newspapers every day, President Trump has yet to express any remorse regarding the horrible hunting down and murder of a black jogger in Georgia. And now President Trump, I think, is trying to make up something called Obamagate, and he wasn't able to give a scintilla of evidence at his press conference yesterday. How do you feel regarding President Trump's regard for the black community?
Well, I keep going back to, David, thank you for that question. I keep going back to President Trump's attempts to woo the black community early on in his tenure, where he says, what do you have to lose? And now in places like Georgia, all across the country, we're seeing African Americans dying disproportionately, I don't even want to say from COVID-19. I would want to say from a lack of national preparedness to deal with the pandemic of COVID-19, which is causing those who are already vulnerable to health issues to actually be vulnerable and to some to succumb to this pandemic. That means that, you know, certainly African Americans have their lives to lose. Have their well-being and their livelihoods and their family members. You know, for African Americans, politics is not a spectator sport. It's mandatory. Politics is the price that we have to pay for survival. And that means that every single one of us need to be mobilized, we need to be energized, and we need to be focused on turning out to vote this man out of office. He does not have our best interests at heart, never has, never will. Now, in terms of, unfortunately, Ahmaud Arbery, I think that, you know, President Trump has shown time and again that he is unable to express empathy. And he is in the cases of, unfortunately, African-Americans, Jewish people, and others who are Muslims who have been under attack, from internal enemies, frankly. He has been unable to and unwilling to express empathy. It is almost as if he is using it for political points with his right-wing base, who is absolutely supportive of, you know, vigilante activity.
Now, Maya, you had quite a love story with Elijah Cummings. I don't think there's any great secret. There's about a 20-year age gap between you and your late husband. How did the two of you meet?
Hello?
Yes, how did you and Elijah meet?
So we met on Capitol Hill. So I went to work on Capitol Hill in 1997. I was a fellow in the office of former Congressman Mel Watt. Then I became staffer, professional staffer on the House Ways and Means Committee, and then I became a chief of staff for former Congressman Charlie Rangel of New York. But in that time, early on in my tenure, I came to Washington to collect data for my dissertation, and one of the first members of Congress to actually accept my request for an interview, and my dissertation was on the African-American political response to HIV/AIDS, was Congressman Elijah Cummings. And I recall that, you know, that interview was just fascinating for me. I labeled him a transformational leader because at a time when the nation was fearful about HIV/AIDS and was stigmatizing those whom they thought were responsible for it and certainly treating, people, gays and lesbians.
All right. We do have to take a break, but we will return in 90 seconds with more from Maya Cummings, candidate for Congress, after this timeout. This is Jim Inkster. Pleased to have you with us. Our guest is Maya Rocky Moore Cummings. She is a candidate for Congress, and she is the widow of Elijah Cummings, the world-renowned congressman from Maryland who died last October. And the president of the United States did not like Congressman Cummings, who was chair of the Oversight Committee. Here's an example of many tweets that the president unleashed against Elijah Cummings, saying Representative Cummings has been a brutal bully, shouting and screaming at the great men and women of Border Patrol about conditions at the southern border when actually his Baltimore district is far worse and more dangerous. His district is considered the worst in the USA. That's from Donald John Trump, president of the United States, who, of course, often talks tough. And when you look at him physically, he is not a strong man, but he has a strong position and he has a bully platform. And the congressman ever gets so frustrated, he said things that in the privacy of your relationship that he would not share with the American people about this man attacking him for what amounted to no good reason.
Well, I mean, I think that the congressman, of course, considered Donald Trump the number one threat to our democracy. He said it publicly, and he said it privately. He was also very concerned about the divisiveness of the president, especially when it came to race and ethnicity. And certainly Donald Trump's message in that tweet right there was focused on, you know, Elijah wanting to make sure that the United States of America lived up to its promise and that we were treating people at the border with humanity. And he felt that the Trump administration was violating human rights and that there was, you know, certainly maliciousness behind their actions. And so he wanted to make sure that he highlighted it and investigated it and righted the wrong. Donald Trump is not a man of honor. Elijah Cummings was.
You have presented something called the New Deal for COVID-19. It's an extensive plan, but what do you view as the major parts of it?
It is unacceptable that we have essential workers and others without health care in this time. We absolutely need to actually have an emergency access for them to have access to health care immediately, whether that is an add-on to Medicare or if it's an add-on to Medicaid. We need to make sure that every essential worker has the personal protective equipment that they need, as well as access to health care. We need to make sure that mental health support is a part of that. And so, you know, a lot of people are depressed and stressed behind COVID-19. And the next crisis on the horizon, many experts say, is a mental health crisis. So we need to get our act together as a nation to make sure that there are mental health supports in place for people. We need an economic safety net. That means that not just $1,200 going to households. We need an economic safety net that provides households with consistent income support over the next few months until this thing ends. And certainly we need strong health policy. The president is out there touting, you know, that we're the nation with the most tests. That is actually a lie. We are actually behind most other countries in terms of testing, in terms of contact tracing, but we need to get it together. And we certainly have the experts at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention who can do it, but they need to be unleashed. And we need to get our act together. We need to get it together now. That means testing, tracking, treating, and and making sure that those infected with COVID-19 get the help that they need. What we're arguing for is a human-centric approach, not an economic, profit-driven, business-oriented approach. We need to make sure that we are paying attention to the human beings so that they don't fall through the huge cracks in our social safety net, and that we actually work to close those gaps so that we'll be not only prepared and well taken care of in this pandemic, but those to come as well.
877-217-5757, if you'd like to get under the wire with Maya Cummings, widow of Elijah Cummings and candidate for Congress in her home city of Baltimore. And for those who are not familiar, Baltimore is a great city, and it has a lot of the cultural greatness and similarities that New Orleans and Baton Rouge have. And, of course, it's a bigger city, but it's on the waterfront, and I'm sure you're quite proud of your hometown, despite what the president says.
It has so many assets. Baltimore is a beautiful city, and people who only know Baltimore through movies like The Wire, shows like The Wire, and come here are just blown away. Our housing stock is unique and gorgeous. Certainly the waterfront port access is just key. We're only, less than 30 minutes away from an international airport. Our people are diverse, vibrant, and productive. And so we just have a lot of assets. But what we need to do is address the deep levels of inequality that do exist, because that inequality combined with poverty is actually driving, unfortunately, things like murder rates and certainly educational attainment rates that aren't what they need to be. And so all it takes is a focused investment, a focused strategy, and certainly partnerships at the state, local, and federal level to actually address that. And it can be done, and it will be done.
Phil in Jefferson Terrace. Phil, good morning. You're on Talk Louisiana. You're on with Maya Cummings.
Good morning, man. It's an honor to talk to you. I know Mr. Cummings has been an inspiration to me personally, and really look to him for his wisdom. Good luck. I mean, they are already gaslighting.
All right. Well, what is your question, Phil?
Well, my question is, what are they going to do about the people who are getting tested and then they have to pay the bill for the help for getting cured, for being in the hospital with this virus?
Actually, I didn't mention it, but that is actually a part of the plan, is to make sure that the out-of-pocket costs that people are expected to pay are actually covered by the federal government. This is something we need to actually make sure that we are addressing the issues of affordability in terms of healthcare access as well during this pandemic, because it helps no one when people either avoid getting the treatment and care that they need because they can't afford it, or they are forced into further economic despair because, the debt accumulates. And so this is a time where we need to pull together. We need to get the fortitude to actually put the right investments in the right place. And this is one where we need to actually make sure that we cover the cost.
Tracy at the Capitol asks if you're confident that a Republican-controlled U.S. Senate, with 5 of the 9 appointees being from GOP presidents, will rule in favor of the request to have the president's tax returns made available.
Thank you for that question, because corruption, as I started this conversation, is a major issue. People don't like to think of the Supreme Court as a political body, but it absolutely is. The appointees are, proposed by partisans, and they are confirmed by partisans. And oftentimes, the appointees themselves are partisans, although, their career is veiled in terms of their service. You can tell by who they, worked for, in terms of who they clerked for, et cetera, what kind of opinions they put out. So unfortunately, I think the question becomes is, will this reveal the court to lack integrity? Because to me, it's a clear-cut, shut door, open and closed case. Or will corruption and partisanship actually prevail and undermine the rule of law? I hope it's the former, not the latter.
Well, Maya Cummings, good luck to you. And the president, among other things, said no human being would want to live in Baltimore. He obviously hasn't spent a lot of time in Baltimore.
Absolutely. And we're all human beings here in Baltimore. We all live here and we'll stay here. So thank you, Jim, for having me on. I deeply appreciate it.
Well, be safe. And you've got a viable opponent and obviously a tough race, but we look forward to catching up and glad in the middle of a campaign you chose to come on the air here in Louisiana. Thank you. And certainly we remember your husband with great affinity and reverence. He was a good man, Elijah Cummings.
Thank you.
Thank you, Maya.
MayaForCongress.com. Take care.
Take care. And we'll return with Lucas Spielfogel. Great name, and he's been around for a little while with the Baton Rouge Youth Coalition. He's got some updates on his fine organization, which is a major part of the fabric of Baton Rouge. You're listening to Talk Louisiana, and we'll return after this pause for the news right here with Lucas Spielfogel. And coming later, Chester Johnson on the Elaine, Arkansas massacre a century ago that took the lives of more than 200 African-American citizens. This is Jim Engster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Matt Doyle is producing and in-house. Lucas Spielfogel. He's a product of Boca Raton, Florida. Went to Yale, one of the great universities in the world. And 10 years ago, he came here as part of the Teach for America program. And he stayed. And this is a great success story that this fine fellow at age 32 has made a home in Baton Rouge and is doing exceptional work with the Baton Rouge Youth Coalition, which is celebrating its 10th anniversary. And 8 of those 10 years, Lucas has been the executive director. And good morning to you.
Good morning, Jim. Thanks so much for having me.
And we're going to cover a little bit of ground with Lucas. But if you'd like to join the conversation, I know many of you are friends of his and associates who know him well. 877-217-5757 is your number. Well, first of all, as far as the organization itself, the Youth Coalition, you're involved in various and sundry activities of importance in our community. What are the same things, some of the things going on right now?
With Baton Rouge Youth Coalition?
Yes.
So just to give the audience a little bit of context, BRIC, or the Baton Rouge Youth Coalition, is a college access and persistence program that takes place after school. We work specifically with high-achieving, under-resourced high school students from 10 different school districts, so mostly from EBR, but really stretching all the way out to the Felicianas, to Pointe Coupee. Obviously, when COVID hit, so in terms of the activities that we're doing right now, we are, of course, an after-school program in person, and as soon as COVID hit and the quarantine took effect on March 13th, it really only took our team about 7 days. By March 20th, we had everything online, and we'd actually doubled the amount of program hours that we were offering. So really proud of the way our team responded in this pandemic.
Well, the governor announced a soft rollout yesterday. Coming Friday, open at 25% capacity with social distancing, aquariums, barbers, bars with food service. Interesting. Mm-hmm. A lot of bars are suddenly going to start serving food, I would imagine. Businesses that are non-essential, and of course, we've been open for business since day one because the media, thank goodness, essential. Casinos and video poker will now be available, as well as churches and funeral homes and gyms and fitness centers and hair salons and malls and movie theaters and museums and nail salons and restaurants, cafes, coffee shops, and zoos. So what does this do for your organization, which, like all others, has had to adjust?
Yeah, honestly, I'm pretty wary about the rollout. That may be a controversial opinion at this point, but I'm going to remain pretty conservative as it relates to COVID. Our plans for the summer are that we are not going to be opening physically until August. So we've already made arrangements for our entire team to be engaged over the summer and pivoted all of our summer programming to online. So, for example, we have a month-long ACT prep camp that was meant to happen in person. That's called Camp S'more Points, and it's going to be happening online.
Well, the presence of Lucas in our studio is welcome, and he is 32, and is this guy, I mentioned the president was not in good physical condition. Well, this guy is in good physical condition. He is a little bit younger, but for people like you, who don't think have any underlying health conditions or in tip-top shape, I don't think it's any huge danger for you to go out, because if you were to get this, you probably would be fine. But for others who do have existing conditions or may be a little more seasoned in the calendar, maybe it's a good idea to take precautions or, if possible, not go out at all. What's your philosophy on where we are right now?
Yeah, so I look at it through a few different lenses, three different lenses. So first of all, personally, my wife and I are really hoping to start a family soon, and so obviously that's something that we need to take into consideration as we go through those steps, always remaining very healthy. So that's lens number one. Lens number two is the Baton Rouge Youth Coalition. We are planning to have 285 students next year, coupled with 350 volunteers. That's a lot of bodies. Mm-hmm. So just considering all those people in relatively tight quarters at our campus, just wanting to be extra safe with that and being on the solution side. And then I think we all have a social responsibility. Of course, being mindful of the economy, but a social responsibility that when we go out, we could be part of the problem, even if we're personally being safe.
877-217-5757 and talk at talklouisiana.org. Holly in the Garden District asks the businesses that are closed. And actually, if you go to your front page of the Advocate today, the governor, by the way, started wearing suits to these press conferences. He looks good in the suit. I think he looks the part, and I think that's a Manuel Martinez suit that he's wearing there. But closed. Children's museums, massage parlors, okay. Public amusement locations, spas, and tattoo parlors. So you're still going to have to wait to get a tattoo if that's in your future.
Yeah, that was my in my summer vision.
Yeah, the man from Boca Raton. This is serious stuff, and you have been in the forefront of helping. You mentioned the children that you were assisting. A lot of these are kids who have needs, and this is something that is admirable and needed in our community, and I'm surprised it took so long for something like this to come about. What was the genesis of the Youth Coalition?
So it goes back to 2009-10, that school year, when a man named Dan Kahn, who also is a Teach for America alum, just recognized as a high school teacher that there were students in his class who ought to be going to four-year colleges. Not every single student is on that track, but he had many who were. But they didn't have the resources to navigate what is a process highly dependent upon the amount of resources you have. So he quit his job and launched BRIC with a handful of students. That was back in 2009, 2010. And then fast forward to today, approaching our 11th year, we have about 380 college students and graduates who boast a 72% four-year college persistence rate, which is more than five times the national average for low-income youth. And then when you incorporate the two-year degree completion, that number shoots up to 80%. So we're really, really proud of what we've been able to do in this decade.
And you have authored a book, The College Playbook.
Yeah, it's funny, Jim, because the first time I was on this show, which was December of 2013, the first and the last time I was, I hope I can come back.
Oh, yeah, sooner, next time.
So it was funny because as soon as I walked out the door, I got a phone call from the father of a man named Craig Gehring. Craig Gehring is the founder and CEO of Mastery Prep, which is, in my opinion, the best college preparatory and test prep company in the country. And that was the beginning of an amazing partnership, a corporate and nonprofit partnership between BRIC and Mastery Prep that has led to many, many things, one of which is my writing of the College Playbook, which is a very comprehensive guide to the college process that is meant to be accessible by all students, no matter their socioeconomic background.
877-217-5757. And for those who'd like a copy of the College Playbook, how do they?
Yeah, so the College Playbook is not typically sold in retail spaces. I would reach out to, I would visit the Mastery Prep website, which I imagine is masteryprep.com, or just Google it. You can reach out to Craig Gehring or Missy Cruz. Typically, the way their business works is they partner with school districts or individual schools and sell the books in bulk, and really proud that they've moved over 15,000 copies at this point.
Of the College Playbook, authored by Lucas Spielvogel. Richard in St. George. Richard, good morning. You're on Talk Louisiana.
Good morning. Thanks, Jim. Hey, Luke, I was curious if you've ever heard of the Upward Bound program. I actually did that whenever I was in high school years ago. I'm not sure if this is an offshoot of it, or if y'all have expanded upon some of the services that they used to offer for the poor kids, if you will, in the area. Thank you.
Yeah, great question. Thank you. I'm very familiar with the Upward Bound program. It is not dissimilar to BRIC in that we both are in the college access space, and they're doing great work to close resource gaps for under-resourced students who don't have the kinds of college application and persistence supports that more advantaged students do. I would say that what differentiates BRIC from Upward Bound is the robustness and the exhaustiveness of the program. So it's not really just a college preparatory program. It's really a holistic youth development program that incorporates even things like counseling, leadership development, connection to extracurricular activities and internships and jobs. So I would say Upward Bound is tremendous, and we're just trying to occupy a slightly smaller niche in terms of the total number of students we're working with across the country, because they're a national network, but going a little bit deeper, perhaps.
Amanda asks about volunteers. I'm sure you rely some on volunteer help.
Really appreciate that question, Amanda. Not only do we rely on volunteer help, our model is impossible without it. We're very unique in that we engage an unusually high number of what we call long-term volunteers. So these are folks who are coming week in, week out to support our students, and these are mentors, tutors. So we're actually in the heat of recruiting our volunteers right now, and if you'd like to learn more about that, you can go to thebrick.org/volunteer.
Mike in Villa Del Rey, you're on with Lucas. Hi, Mike.
Hey, good morning. I don't know how much this is on subject, but I'm an old man, and I'm getting ready to take free college courses that's offered through Union Plus. Any union members affiliated with this and their family members to get the first 2 years of college absolutely free.
That's a great program.
Yeah, that's a great program, and I applaud you for being a lifelong learner, sir.
There you go. Learning is important at any age. When you stop learning, you stop living. As I mentioned, you're from balmy Boca Raton, went to Yale, one of the great schools in the world, and you've spent 10 years in Baton Rouge. You probably never thought you would, but why did you stay?
Definitely never in a million years thought I would. Even couldn't believe it when I was invited to come here for Teach for America, but I think this place really grows on you. There's so much about this place that I've come to love, from the things that people mostly talk about, which are the cultural elements, such as the food and the happy, rich feeling that they have here. But the community that I've built here is tremendous, and that's through BRIC, through my faith-based experience, through my friends. But the most important thing is my work. My work is really my heart, and I love doing it. I love waking up every single morning. Hope to do it for another 10 years at least.
Well, let's bring you back twice a year rather than twice a decade. So we look forward to hearing from you in about 6 months, if not sooner, Lucas. But congratulations for the Baton Rouge Youth Coalition.
Thank you,
great
Jim.
Work.
Appreciate you.
And we'll return with more Talk Louisiana after this brief timeout. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana, 877-217-5757. We switch gears, and we're joined now by one of the prominent historians in our country, Chester Johnson, who I believe was born in the great city of Monticello, Arkansas. And he's written about a terrible event in his home state a century ago, 1919, in Elaine, Arkansas, which is about an hour's drive north of the Louisiana border on the west side of state. And Elaine, Arkansas is the hometown of the great Levon Helm of the band. He was born there about 20 years after the massacre at Elaine. And Chester, good morning to you.
Well, good morning. Thank you for having me.
Did I get it right? You're from Monticello?
I am from Monticello. I actually was born in Chattanooga, but and then my father died, and we family moved back to Arkansas and southeast Arkansas, and I grew up in Monticello.
And you have opined about this for some time, and you have a book. And tell us about the odyssey you had in uncovering all the horrors of the Elaine massacre.
Well, I grew up in Drew County, which is one county removed from Phillips County, where the massacre occurred. I actually did not hear anything about it while I was growing up, neither did my friends and classmates. But then in 2008, I was asked by the Episcopal Church, National Episcopal Church, to write the Litany of Offense and Apology for the National Day of Repentance, when the church apologized for its role in slavery and related evils. And during the time that I was doing my research, I came across this book written by the African-American historian and anti-lynching advocate Ida B. Wells. It was entitled The Arkansas Race Riot of 1919, and I began doing research and further research in it and into it, and that is when I discovered this Elaine race massacre. And what was particularly personal is that as I delved into it and in an intensive way, I ultimately discovered that my maternal grandfather, who actually reared me from the time I was one until I started to school, because my mother didn't do particularly well in the years after my father's death, and I discovered that he had participated in this massacre as an employee of the Missouri Pacific Railroad, which was up to its eyeballs in the massacre as a result of its activities within Phillips County. I couldn't let it go. I continued to work on it. Eventually, it evolved. My interest evolved into a connection with a number of other people's interests in it, and I became the co-chair of the Elaine Massacre Memorial Committee. And we had there had never been a permanent physical memorial to this massacre until end of September at the centennial, and we had a wonderful dedication, and it's a great structure. The one thing that I didn't mention here is that the extent of the massacre, which it's pretty well determined that well over 100 and possibly hundreds of African Americans were killed in this massacre, which occurred in late September and early October of 1919.
All right, hold that thought. Chester Johnson is our guest. The book is Damaged Heritage, The Elaine Race Massacre and a Story of Reconciliation. And this was in 1919. Last September 30th was the century anniversary of this awful tragedy. African Americans at that time outnumbered whites 10-1. 3-1 in the county overall, and white landowners controlled the economy, selling cotton on their own schedule, running high-priced plantation stores where farmers had to buy seed and supplies, and settling accounts with sharecroppers and lump sums without listing items. And black farmers began to organize to try to negotiate better conditions, including fair accounting and timely payment of monies due them by the white landowners, and then a riot broke out. And before we get to the horror of that riot, which, as you say, may have taken the lives of close to 300 African-American people. You know, I grew up 10 years in North Little Rock, and Arkansas. It was blessed with some outstanding politicians who were progressive on race after the horror of Orville Faubus, people like Bill Clinton and David Pryor and Dale Bumpers and Winthrop Rockefeller, a Republican. And I never heard them talk about this. This was something, as you say, that was an untold story, and maybe one that the people of the great state of Arkansas didn't want to talk about a lot.
I think that's exactly right. There are several things that happened. One is that the event occurred in a fairly remote area of the state, right along the Mississippi River Delta. Upon the massacre completion of that of the week that basically was the massacre, when federal troops were brought in with machine guns and they did most of the damage, et cetera, et cetera, it was It was seen. It was in a the African American community within a large number of people within African American community in Phillips County left, and the remaining African Americans. There was a sense that, you know, is this going to happen again, and under what conditions could it happen again, and the city, the county fathers, the plutocrats, the white planters, they sent out messages to African American community, stop talking, just stop talking. And so there was a clear message being sent out about that, and the whites were not particularly enthusiastic about talking about it either, of course. Since they were the perpetrators, including my my grandfather. Time rolled on, and then a white narrative developed that there were only 15 to 25 killed, and that was the first day. And the military, federal troops came in just to restore order, and that's all they did, even though there were a series of studies done by the FBI and the Justice Department to determine that, you know, we were looking at 80 persons killed, at least 80 persons killed by the federal troops, and possibly much larger.
Well, how were these people killed? How did their lives end in this massacre?
Well, the first morning, there was a union meeting on the evening of September the 30th, as you correctly pointed out. And at this meeting, a person from Missouri Pacific Railroad and the deputy sheriff came in, fired into the church. They didn't realize that the union had hired guards. The guards fired back. The Missouri Pacific official was killed. The deputy sheriff was wounded. And the following morning, the sheriff had deputized a large number of white persons within the county, and they descended upon an area called Hoop Spur, where the African Americans were living, and they proceeded to kill a number. Now, there were of African Americans between 15 and 20 just that morning. But
were they lynched?
No, they were shot. They were. It was purely by being shot. But there were two whites who were killed, and the local sheriff. And quite frankly, I think both of them were actually killed by friendly fire, but that's another story. And the local sheriff called the governor, said there's a black insurrection occurring here in Phillips County. We need some help. The governor called the War Department. It was Woodrow Wilson's administration. Called the War Department, asked for use of the federal troops at Camp Pike, which was right outside of Little Rock. Immediately, the federal government authorized the use of these troops and their machine guns to go to Phillips County. And they did. And over the succeeding 3 to 4 days, there were a series of killings by the federal troops, primarily through the use of the machine guns. That was by far the largest component of the deaths experienced by the African Americans.
The book is Damaged Heritage, from J. Chester Johnson, The Elaine Race Massacre, and A Story of Reconciliation, about terrible tragedy north of our border in Arkansas in 1919, a story that is worth retelling and shows that we have advanced as a society to some degree. Signature support comes from First Financial Tax and Accounting Services. Stay tuned.